During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Good evening and welcome. It's Tuesday and it's time for another Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and back where he belongs, across the board from me, the one and only and lovable Mr. Tim Dennis. Good evening, Tim.
Evening.
Got a good week lined up for you.
Yeah, we do.
End of the week, Tim. We're going to be discussing Ouija. There is so much surrounding Ouija. People are terrified of this piece of cardboard and plastic. Is there a reason? Should they be afraid of it? We're going to discuss with Ouija board historian Bob Murch some of the history and some of the most terrifying accounts he's collected over the years, including some amazing historic accounts. We're also going to speak with Dr. Michael Shermer from Skeptic Magazine to get an insight into how Ouija board on how Ouija boards work. Are we responsible for this, as many people think? Is our mind powerful enough to create lesions on our skin, an addiction to these boards, all the other strange accounts that go along with it? We'll discuss that with Dr. Michael Shermer on Friday, plus a brand new Theater of the Mind. And of course, on Thursday, Roy Horn is going to join us. We're going to talk about a topic, Tim, that has been capturing the imagination of our audience with Darkness Radio for years and really seems to be catching fire around the world, the Mandela effect.
Oh, yes.
The idea that these false memories seem to be surfacing, people in mass remembering specific things, and they are wrong. There are verses of the Bibles that have now changed and people recall them one way. It's something completely different. Is this nothing but a hiccup and a glitch in our own matrix, in our own mind? Have we convinced ourselves that there are these changes that never really existed? And if so, why do a certain number of the populace remember things specifically and in great detail one way, while the rest remembers it the way it looks now? We'll talk about that on Thursday. Wednesday show, Sean Wickens joins us, Tim. Conspiracies. We're going to talk about tolerable conspiracies. Some secrets are good for you. Comedian Sean Wickens has written a book and examines popular conspiracies, finding the weirder silver linings behind them. We always talk about the dark side of conspiracies,
well,
Tim.
Yeah.
It's time to find the good in assassination. And
there's good?
We'll find out, I guess.
Huh.
But tonight, let's get started. People love when we go into the weird realm of cryptids and strange creatures. And tonight, Seth Breedlove, no, he's not the weird creature, Tim. He's here to talk to us about the topic of the Mothman of Point Pleasant. And I'm sure we'll get into other topics as well. Seth is the founder of the award-winning Small Town Monsters production company. He's the film director for the upcoming documentary, The Mothman of Point Pleasant, which will be coming out in June. And the documentary film goes into retell the Mothman legend through eyewitness testimony and the perspective of Point Pleasant citizens. The Mothman, again, was first sighted back in 1966, and sightings have continued until around the time that a bridge that connected the West Virginia town of Point Pleasant to Ohio collapsed back in 1967. There was a movie made about this starring Richard Gere. Horrible movie. Horrible movie. But Seth is here to talk to us about the real story behind this. Seth, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And I outright instantly have to disagree with you about the Mothman Prophecies movie. I'm a huge fan of that Richard Gere Richard Gere movie.
Do not make me remove my shirt and oil my chest and offer to go to a bare knuckle fist fight with you, Seth Breedlove. I will if I have to. You know, I don't know what it was about it. I did not find that movie engaging. I thought it was schlocky, but you stand by it, even though the story was totally fictionalized the way they did it and kind of updated.
Yeah. So, I mean, I credit that movie in a lot of ways with introducing me to the paranormal, the reality of like the paranormal subjects in general, because at that point when I saw Mothman Prophecies in theaters, I was not into any of this stuff. So that movie was the first time I became aware that there were people that really believed things like the Mothman existed. So in a lot of ways, I think that movie opened my eyes to the subject that I had never really, you know, been aware of in any capacity. And also just, I have great, really fond memories of going to see the Mothman Prophecies with friends of mine multiple times. We went back to see it multiple times.
Wow. Now there's a paranormal thing we need to investigate for future shows, Seth. Just do me a favor. Avoid American Gigolo. If you're impacted by Richard Gere's work, I don't need you watching that movie. Let's get into it. So the Mothman of Point Pleasant, there's been a lot spoken about, and I think we've only covered the Mothman on our show briefly a couple of times over 12 years. What can you tell us that we know as fact from many eyewitness accounts? What can you tell us? And let's start back in 1966 with these first sightings.
Sure. Well, the 66 sightings are typically credited as being the first. There were technically sightings of similar creature, you know, a similar Mothman type creature that go all the way back to like the World War One era in Point Pleasant. We've turned up, you know, numerous reports around that area. And there's an author named Mark Hall, author and cryptozoologist, that Lauren Coleman actually introduced me to his work. And he wrote about a giant bird in Point Pleasant back during the World War One era that preceded tragedies. So obviously this is something that wasn't just popping up in 1966, but those 66 sightings are where the story first kind of hit the mainstream. And most of that, the credit for that goes to the kind of famous Linda Scarberry, Roger Scarberry, mallet sighting that took place out by the TNT area, which is the story that typically people know. There were two couples that were out driving around this abandoned munitions area outside of Point Pleasant, and they saw this bizarre man-like bird standing by the road. And the bird ended up chasing their car all the way back to Point Pleasant, where they went and kind of told the police about the story. And from there, the story blew up and became a typical, you know, whenever we're making these small town monsters movies, we notice that there's a kind of typical set of rules that these stories follow. Some person or person sees a creature, they report it to someone, whether it's, you know, the media or the local police. Either way, it eventually hits a newspaper or radio. And then before you know it, the third kind of part of that equation is that mobs of people start going out trying to hunt down a monster. And that was obviously the case with the Mothman story, because, you know, within days of people hearing about this story, there were literally armed posses out at the TNT area kind of patrolling the area looking to kill a monster.
Doesn't that kind of shock you, Seth? I mean, the idea that 1966, all you have to do is make a claim that a large winged creature, humanoid winged creature, is seen, and people took it realistically enough that they went out with shotguns and created posses to try to hunt this beast down when nobody had seen it really prior. I mean, it wasn't a buzz. It wasn't, you know, a danger legend in the past. It just seems to me, I mean, 1966 is 51 years ago. It seems like they should have been a little bit more enlightened to the idea that, you know, or it's certainly taken a little bit more to convince them to go out hunting for a beast.
Yeah, I think what happened is this particular story hit the media and people kind of laughed it off. But you had subsequent sightings that happened over the next 3 days that were kind of highly publicized as well. So the next night you had There was a sighting that took place out at the TNT area again with four or five people that claimed to see it. And then the I think it was November 18th, you had another sighting take place. So it kind of was an ongoing thing where multiple people seen it, and this all happened within the span of about 4 days. And from there you had these posses forming, because I guess they really just put a lot of stock in what witnesses were saying back then.
I guess when these other, sightings began to happen, and I know this is kind of hard to determine, especially at this point, but how reputable were the people that were coming forward with the continuation of these stories? You know, were you seeing police or, and again, it's hard to say this because I don't want to seem dismissive of anybody's belief system, but is it just bored house people that saw this, or was it, you know, people that you would think of having a good reputation who would certainly not want to be laughed at or made fun of for coming forward about this kind of story?
Yeah, the people that were claiming to see this creature, I think were mostly reputable, especially early on, before this had become kind of a thing where I think in a lot of ways you could have seen it as a, not a mass hysteria, but people wanting to get in on the story and have their own sightings, because that did eventually seem to become an issue. But these early sightings, the Scarberries and the Mallets were just some kids who were out driving around. I really don't think they were looking to, you know, have an encounter with a monster and be known as people who had had an encounter with a monster. In fact, they all distanced themselves from the story after it had happened because of the negative impact it had on their reputation in the town and things like that. Before that, they were known to be good people, and they still were afterward, right. But there was still this, they were connected to the Mothman at that point. But definitely the sighting that took place out at the TNT factory the following night, that was a very reputable group of people that had a sighting. And then
let's start off with that first sighting. Can you give me the details? I mean, what happened on the initial encounter with this creature?
With the Scarberries and the Mallets?
Yes.
They were out driving around the TNT area, and basically, apparently, according to them, they were out trying to catch parkers. So kids that were out parking, they'd pull up behind them and flash your brights, because apparently that's what you do in a small town for fun. And so they're out, you know, doing that. And they're in this abandoned area called the TNT factory area. And they see a creature standing by the road that looks like a man. I think their initial sort of description was a man-like bird. Now there's two versions of that, what they saw this creature doing. One of them is that they saw the creature trying to free its wing from a wire. And then there's another account that just kind of says it was standing by the road, but whatever it was doing, it was by the road. And the creature seems to notice them and proceeds to come after their car. Well, they basically take off up to speeds of 95 miles an hour, trying to get out of the TNT area and back to town with this creature, this glowing red-eyed man-like bird, chasing their car. They go all the way into town, and they report it to the police. And that's kind of what I was saying. That's once they report it to the police, what happens is the police call a press conference the next day, which also happens to be the same day that this other group of people have a sighting out near the TNT area. And that sighting, the sighting that happens the next day, is kind of a famous sighting as well, because it involved a lady named Marcella Bennett, who actually had her baby Tina with her at the time. And they were going to visit a friend that actually lived out in the TNT factory area. And they had just pulled up at the house. And as they got out of the car, they noticed these strange lights in the sky. And that's their description. That's what they're describing seeing in the sky, is basically a UFO. So they get out of the car and they see these strange lights in the sky. And they're looking at that. And then one of them notices a figure standing near the driveway of this house they're at. And it's basically the same figure that the Scarberries and the Mallets had described seeing. So basically they see the Mothman as well. And it's at that point that they start to run to the house. Marcella dropped her baby and ended up falling on it, trying to, I guess, help it or save it or whatever from the Mothman, scooped up the baby. They all run into the house. And when they're in the house, they recount that the creature comes to the window, and they actually see the creature look into the house at them. Now, I actually, Marcella passed away a few years ago, although she is in some of these Mothman documentaries that have been around. So you can actually hear her account of the event. And we actually have an interview with her that'll be in our film as well. Even though she's passed away, we got access to an old video interview with her that's never been out there. But I spoke to another member of the party that was there that night, and she did back up the fact that the Mothman or something with glowing red eyes was staring in the window at them, actually, after they had retreated into this house. So those are kind of the two big events that kicked it off. But the thing to keep in mind is that there were sightings going on all around this area of large birds, freakishly large birds, weird, you know, man-like birds and things like that. In addition to that, there's also a lot of UFO activity taking place simultaneously.
Interesting. Now, is there any kind of native legend and lore for these giant birds? Are they phoenix? Are they redbirds? What exactly is the history behind this, do you think?
So yeah, the reference I always give is to guys like Ken Gerhard and Mark Hall and Lauren Coleman, who have all written kind of extensively about Thunderbirds and those stories. And my research into this has primarily been with these initial Mothman legends. But the fascinating thing that I'm finding in looking at these guys' work, like Ken's work and Mark Hall and Lauren Coleman, is that there are centuries worth of these types of, you know, Thunderbird sightings. Now, whether or not you can connect the Thunderbird to what people were seeing in Point Pleasant in 66 and 67, I just don't, personally, I don't see a connection between the two. Because to me, the Mothman is so many different things to so many different people. The descriptions of it kind of range across the board. There are sightings from 66 of what sound more like your traditional Thunderbird, almost like a pterodactyl type creature. But when people are talking about a winged man-like, you know, being like those initial Thunder or Mothman sightings, to me that it doesn't sound, you know, like what you connect the native traditional native description of the Thunderbird as being.
Right.
But there are similarities, especially in the fact that you, if you want to bring the Silver Bridge collapse and the loss of life that happened there into this, then I guess you could connect it to Thunderbird legend since that kind of tragedy, you know, the forebearer of a tragedy kind of being connected to the Thunderbird. That is a thing. And that's definitely a part of those early legends.
So how many sightings took place from the initial onset until the bridge collapse of this creature?
That's one of the things about this story that I'm trying to uncover for myself, because John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies book, in his book, he said there were hundreds. And that has kind of been echoed by many other people. But what I don't understand about that is when I look into Keel's work, he doesn't source 100 plus sightings or hundreds of sightings. He talks about a handful of sightings, basically. Maybe I think maybe 25 sightings if you read the Mothman Prophecies and some of the other books he wrote where he, you know, talked about the Mothman situation. And then there were guys like Lauren Coleman who've written about it, who have a couple sightings that weren't, you know, written about by Keel. But personally, I haven't been able to turn up these hundreds of sightings. So I hesitate to say there were hundreds of sightings because I don't personally have them. But according to Keel, there really were hundreds. So what Keel talks about are in the neighborhood of 25 sightings that he thought were the cream of the crop is the words he used.
And those did are this all happen
with
within
very reliable witnesses and, you know, just fascinating kind of sightings.
Did this all happen at specific times of day? Did it happen in one geographic area, or were people all over West Virginia seeing this creature?
So it's happening across West Virginia and into Ohio, because we have sightings as far away from Point Pleasant as Hocking County. And of course, when you start factoring in things like the Woodrow Derenberger, you know, the UFO and the grinning man story, which is kind of a famous one that's often connected to the Mothman story. Now, this was definitely not just Point Pleasant, although the movie I'm making will focus pretty much solely on the Point Pleasant area and those particular stories. There's a movie called Eyes of the Mothman that kind of delves into the larger situation, like everything, all the UFO sightings, everything unusual going on outside of Point Pleasant even. As for times of the day and times of year, this started in November of 1966. And it pretty much, when you're talking about Mothman sightings, they pretty much stopped being reported on right around the time of the bridge collapse. So the bridge collapses in 1967, December of 1967. And pretty much after that, you don't read articles, you know, in any papers or anything about Mothman being seen. Now, whether or not people stop seeing him is kind of up for debate. I mean, from what my research shows, that there are people that still claim to see Mothman, but it never happened again in that kind of crazy day after day kind of thing that was going on very early with the Mothman story. And that's one of the things that drew me about this particular story, was the fact that so many of these sightings were, you know, one day this person would have a sighting here, and the next day someone's having a sighting over here. So it was kind of a continuous thing, though, over that 13-month period.
What a strange phenomenon, right? I mean, you've got this kind of mass hysteria buildup slowly over the period of a year, and then the culmination of it is this bridge collapse, and suddenly there's no more sighting. Is there ever an actual sighting of the Mothman on this bridge, at this bridge, near this bridge? And I mean, not just, well, yeah, he was a couple miles down the road. I mean, anything that would put him there that would actually tie him to the collapse.
There are vague kind of accounts, mm-hmm, of, I can only really think of one. A truck driver who was coming over the bridge claimed to see the Mothman on the bridge around the time of the bridge collapse. But the thing that bothers me about that sighting is he reported that years after the bridge collapsed. You know, this isn't something where he reported his sighting immediately afterward or anything. This was years later, and even after the Mothman had become kind of a pop culture icon because of the movie and, you know, because so many documentaries being done about the subject, that guy kind of came forward with that story. Personally, I don't see any evidence to connect Mothman with the bridge collapse. Mm-hmm. Although the bridge collapse will play a major part in the movie I'm making, because that's one of the things that drew me to the story, is that Silver Bridge collapse and how much it affected the town. But to me, it reads like this is a very bizarre 13-month span of time where it's not just the Mothman, it's the Mothman and UFOs and Men in Black and all kind of unusual activity going on around Point Pleasant during this 13-month span. And in the movie, we talked to Jeff Wamsley, who runs the Mothman Museum, and he talked about how it's almost like a pattern of escalation, where things seem to be escalating towards something, and it apparently was the bridge.
What was the cause of the bridge collapse? Do we know that for a fact?
Yeah, it sounds like it was the I-bar, which is getting into an area where I'm not technically adept. Like, I don't quite understand the I-bar, but there was a pin that held the I-bar together, and the pin would have actually been the 13th I-bar on the bridge that kind of held the bridge in place, and that gave out. And when that happened, the bridge swung to one side and dumped all the cars that were sitting off on the bridge at that time onto one side of the river. And then it swung wildly to the other side of the river and dumped all the other cars off onto the other side of the river. People pretty much would have died very quickly once they hit the water. It was the coldest day that year. It might have been the coldest day on record, but it was the coldest day that year. the water would have been freezing cold. And then most of the cars that went into the water, the bridge would have fallen on top of them. So that, you know, there were two bodies that were never even recovered after the bridge collapse. So as far as the, what caused the bridge collapse, that's what I was saying. I don't really see anything supernatural here, or really even out of the ordinary. The only thing that's out of the ordinary to me is that they had checked the bridge. The bridge was routinely checked and had just been checked in September of 1967. So it had only been checked a few months earlier, and it collapsed, you know, 4 months later, killing 46 people. So, but it seems like it was that eye bar pin.
Was there, just out of curiosity, was there any report of sounds happening prior to the bridge collapse? You know, metal moaning, a high frequency, anything that anybody has ever talked about or encountered with that tragedy?
I haven't personally seen anything that recounts that.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, not necessarily connected to your question, but we did hear a really interesting story when we were down there. There was a guy that actually claimed to have video of the bridge actually collapsing. Unfortunately, they've never been able to turn up this video, but the guy had told someone that he had a video that actually showed the top of the bridge. It was shot from somewhere in Point Pleasant, and you could see the bridge in the background, the top of the bridge, the top, you know, kind of the very top of the one tower on the bridge. You actually saw it snap and go sideways. So as far as like unusual sounds or anything like that, I've never heard any account of that where they mentioned that. That's a good question, though.
Such a fascinating story. Weird angles to it. We're going to talk more about some of the other legend and lore when we continue speaking with Seth regarding the documentary and his story.
Beyond the darkness.
Welcome back to Beyond the Darkness, the Mothman of Point Pleasant. That's our topic this evening as we talk with Seth Breedlove. And he is with Small Town Monsters. They produced 3 award-winning films, including the recent Boggy Creek Monster, which took all honors at the annual Hollywood International Independent Documentary Awards. You're working on the new program, The Mothman of Point Pleasant. And Seth, you've got a Kickstarter that launches this Thursday. Tell our listeners a little bit about it and what they can do to help out.
Yeah, this will actually be our third Kickstarter campaign too in about 3 years. So we typically turn to crowdfunding to fund the production of our movies. Although this time I kind of wanted to make the Mothman movie. I wouldn't say it was spontaneous, but it kind of just happened. So I basically funded the movie out of pocket, but we knew we wanted to put out 2 movies in 2017. So this is our first movie, and then our second movie is going to be called Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, and it's going to kind of delve into the Kecksburg UFO crash and some of that stuff. But we're launching a Kickstarter on Thursday, February 2nd, to basically fund the production of both of those movies. So if you back, you get, you know, like your name in the credits is like one of the rewards, and we have all sorts of stuff planned out. There's like we have a poster designed by Sam Sheeran, who's done all of our other posters, and Sam's also designing us a t-shirt, a Mothman t-shirt. And then we'll have a Small Town Monsters t-shirt, a really cool Small Town Monsters poster. And then one of the coolest things, and like the thing that I've been geeking out over, because I've always wanted to have some sort of like collectible made around one of my movies. We partnered with these guys called Creature Replica,
okay,
who do kind of cryptid action figures and stuff. And one of their guys, Gene St. Jean, who does sculpting for he's actually kind of a huge deal when it comes to sculpting and action figures. He's done work for like Marvel and DC and all that kind of stuff, but he's actually sculpting a Mothman statue, and we're going to have like a variant Mothman statue as one of the rewards in the Kickstarter campaign. So if you're super into Mothman and you feel like you need a statue in your room of Mothman, you'll be able to have one with this campaign. So
Tim will be excited if you're going to ever do the inflatable Mothman.
Yeah, you got one of those?
Yeah, that's coming later this year.
Is there handles on the wings?
The works.
If there's handles on the wings, I'm in.
Oh my God, literally.
Well, I'll run it by the prototype department.
Check out the website smalltownmonsters.com to keep up with what's going on with them and the projects that they're working on. We'll have a link up right here at podcast1.com. You can find it with the download of the show. There's been a lot said about this Mothman story, and I know that, you know, the Richard Gere movie that you liked that I was not so crazy about helped to perpetuate a lot of false aspects of the story. Can you address some of the pieces out there that have been regaled as part of the legend that really have nothing to do with the story at all, and you can find no stories, no evidence to support any of that part?
Well, what it seems to me like so many parts of this story have been blown up over the years. I mean, typically people talk about the Mothman as if it was factually 100% some sort of omen, like it was an omen of things to come. And while that could very well be the case, I mean, no one knows what the Mothman was. Like I said earlier, there's so many different descriptions that were going on of what people were seeing. Some people were seeing a giant bird, and some people were seeing a man with wings, and you know, some people were seeing more of a pterodactyl type creature. So it's very unusual when it comes to the physical descriptions of this thing that not even those seem to line up. So as far as the bridge collapsing, I think people typically think of that picture. There's a horribly photoshopped picture floating around the internet that shows what looks like the Mothman on top of the Silver Bridge, and basically it was photoshopped. There was no photograph taken of Mothman at the bridge.
What, nobody whipped out their cell phone and snapped a picture back then?
No, unfortunately, the time travelers that had their cell phones on the bridge at that time did not think to do that. But yeah, I mean, basically, there's nothing connecting the Mothman directly to the Silver Bridge, other than a couple testimonies, one or two testimonies that came after the fact, years after the fact. You know, there were so many. What we're finding with the story is that a lot of it seems to be folktale, kind of modern folktale or folk legend, where people repeat a fact, quote unquote fact, for decades until it becomes a fact to most people. But if you really track some of these stories down to the beginning, things have been, you know, blown out of proportion or exaggerated over the years. People were definitely seeing something in 1966. It's just that it doesn't seem like it was the same thing over and over. And when you factor in the Men in Black sightings that started occurring and the UFO activity going on around that area, which the UFO activity in West Virginia is kind of legendary to begin with. I mean, you could track that all the way back to the Flatwoods Monster case and even earlier. So West Virginia in general, Appalachia in general, actually has a long history of bizarre kind of folk legend and things like that, folk tales. A lot of this story is misunderstood or misrepresented. I think the biggest thing that jumps out to me about Point Pleasant is the Curse of Cornstalk, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but it's often referenced back in the time of the Native Americans and the French and Indian War and all that. There was a native chieftain named Cornstalk, and he was kind of tasked with brokering peace between the settlers in the area and the natives in the area. And Chief Cornstalk was brutally murdered by some of the settlers at Point Pleasant. And the legend goes that as he was dying, he cursed the town and all of its people basically until the end of time is kind of how the legend goes. And that story,
boy, talk about holding a grudge.
Right, right. And that story has been kind of repeated in every documentary or book I've seen about this. Like, it's fact. And what we came to find out while we were there is that Chief Cornstalk never, that we can find any evidence of, never actually placed a curse on the town or anyone. In fact, that's actually against Shawnee, you know, what the Shawnees believed. They weren't permitted and were forbidden to place curses. And beyond that, the story seems to originate in a play that was performed at the Point Pleasant School back in the early 1900s. We actually managed to find the playbill that has the script where they originally kind of came up with this curse and put it in this play. So that story has been, you know, repeated over the decades since, and it's serious in Point Pleasant. People, they even teach the curse of Cornstalk there like it's a real thing. And people in town legitimately believe that, you know, Cornstalk cursed their land, and that's why they've had so many, you know, bad things happen to Point Pleasant.
What about these mysterious phone calls that Richard Gere was getting in the movie, this creepy voice and haunting messages? Was there ever any reality to that happening to anybody at the time or after?
Yeah, that's kind of a culmination of a few different things. The character, Richard Gere's character in the movie, is basically playing a variation, a good-looking variation of John Keel. Keel claimed to receive phone calls from not from the Mothman, but from a person who would essentially predict things, hence the title of the book, The Mothman Prophecies. And so Keel was the one that was actually receiving these bizarre phone calls. A lot of the book, The Mothman Prophecies, spends very little time actually on the Mothman. It's mostly about the prophecies that were given to Keel and UFO activity and Men in Black and some of the really unusual things that were going around that area at that time. The closest book I've seen where they focus solely on the Mothman sightings would be, there's a book by Lauren Coleman about Mothman, and then there's a book by a guy that grew up in Point Pleasant who we interviewed in our movie, named George Dudding. And he did a book called The Mason County Mothman. Those are like the only two books I found where they focus solely on the Mothman cases and leave out some of the other weirder stuff. But the phone calls are basically based on what was happening to John Keel himself. Although there were accounts of people hearing very unusual things kind of in the sky. People would recount walking down a city street and they could hear something in the air above them, almost like there were disembodied voices speaking above them. But there's no one there, obviously. And there were things like that and strange humming sounds. And, you know, a lot of what goes on in the Mothman Prophecies movie is kind of a combination of many different things that took place in Point Pleasant back in 66. But there definitely were phone calls being made to Keel. It's just, you know, was that actually someone, you know, predicting the future to Keel, or was it someone playing a prank on Keel? I mean, those are the questions we all have, I think.
Well, that's what I was asking earlier. Just prior to the bridge collapse, had there been any weird sounds? Because you'd think, since there were Men in Black and alien and craft sightings of that time, it almost makes you wonder if the bridge had just been tested and checked and everything seemed to be fine, if any of these weird sounds seem to have been leading up to the bridge collapse, could it have been experiments that were being made and done on the people of Point Pleasant at the time, either creating these hallucinations, creating these issues? Could it have been the propulsion system of a cloaked UFO if they were hearing sounds over their heads and loud humming noises? Could it have been something to be attributed to that? I mean, you know, that's where I always found that aspect of the story kind of fascinating and wondered if people have ever kind of, you know, tracked down that rabbit hole.
There's actually an account that someone gave of seeing two men on the bridge days before the collapse. So, I mean, anything's possible. And the UFO sightings can't be understated, really, when it comes to this case. During 66 and 67, especially, they were being cited as much, if not more, than the Mothman itself. There were points in time where people knew, especially Keel, knew they could go to this spot on this day, and you would more than likely see a UFO. So that's how crazy things had gotten in the area. There were frequent sightings of UFOs, but again, tying it to the bridge collapse is difficult.
Sure.
Given the fact that no one recounted seeing a UFO, you know, in the air at that time. And the other thing you have to be really cautious of when it comes to something like, which we're obviously very aware of because we're trying to make a movie about it. But when you're in Point Pleasant, everyone in that town lost someone that they knew or were related to on that bridge. You know, you're talking about a town of a couple thousand people, and 46 people died on that bridge. I know the mayor lost relatives on the bridge when it collapsed. So everyone knew someone that was on the bridge, and you have to be very cautious to be, you know, to wander into town or try to talk to someone about the bridge collapse and be like, well, do you think it was a UFO? You know, because this is someone that might have lost a son or husband on that bridge.
The aspect that, you know, all of this strange phenomena was taking place in one area. Was there any reference in things like Project Blue Book regarding the UFOs in that area? Was there ever an official explanation given by the government at any time for what these craft might have been?
The government has tried to explain away the Mothman sightings. As for UFOs, no, but they did. There was an article written not too long ago, a year or two ago, that basically claimed that what people were seeing in Point Pleasant was a paratrooper, basically a special paratrooper suit that was being developed back then. And that's what people were seeing. And in a way it would make sense. There's a National Guard armory probably a mile from the TNT factory area where the early sightings took place. In addition to that, there was some sort of, I want to say it was a naval headquarters or something like that, actually in downtown Point Pleasant back then. So there was definitely like a military presence in the area, and still is even today. But you know, it's hard to say if the government actively was looking into the UFO sightings or not. But they did try to, just recently, they tried to explain away the, at least the Mothman sightings, as being basically like a prototype paratrooper suit that was being tested at the time.
Right, because of all places in the world, why wouldn't you test a prototype paratrooper uniform in West Virginia?
In a contaminated, highly contaminated wildlife area, yeah.
Yeah, makes all the sense in the world to me. When you do the research for your documentaries about these type of monsters, and, you know, even looking at Boggy Creek, are there similarities to the way people recount these stories? Are there similarities in the timing or anything that you can look at and say, you know, this is an interesting aspect of these type of eyewitness accounts?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to physical descriptions, what always gets me is the red eyes, because like that seems to run across Bigfoot. You know, Black Panthers, Mothman, people recount seeing the red eyes. As for, you know, talking to witnesses, yeah, I think the similarities I'm noticing the most between the cases is the way people talk about these things. They don't want to recount their stories for the most part. People are always claiming that eyewitnesses are just hoaxing or making up encounter stories, you know, for popularity or fame. But for the most part, the people that tell us their encounter stories, I spent a great deal of time just trying to convince them to come on camera and tell us their story. For the most part, the people we get in these films are very hesitant to tell about their encounters because they've been made fun of and that kind of thing. And when you factor in something like the Mothman, despite the fact that it's had a very positive influence, you know, on the community as far as financial and tourism aspect, it's extremely difficult to get people who are around in 66 and 67 to talk to us about it because they don't want to be connected to the Mothman due to fear of like ridicule,
right?
Which rings very true to like the Boggy Creek case, especially like you mentioned, that's something we ran into there. And then the Beast of Whitehall film we made, that was a similar thing that ran across that. So that's what I noticed the most. And then kind of the impact it has on the lives of the people that witness these things. In the case of the Mothman, it's had the most dramatic impact on people that we've seen with any of our films, just because there was a real negative aspect to this for Linda Scarberry, who was involved in the initial sightings, and she kind of claimed it haunted her the rest of her life. Literally, she actually said that she was seeing shadow people and poltergeist activity and stuff was taking place in her home after her sighting. And she tried to distance herself from this all the way up until her death. So I think the kind of the ongoing negative impact of the Mothman sightings stands out from the rest of the films we've made, especially.
When you look into this and you're talking to people that had these eyewitness accounts, you know, 50 years ago, 51 years ago, and they've been reluctant to come forward and share their stories, what is that straw that seems to break their back to finally get them to come forward about this? Is it just setting the record straight, getting it off of their chest? What do you feel is the connection that makes them want to surface all these years later?
I think for the most part, these people want to prove they're not crazy. And they want you to believe that what they saw is what they saw and not question everything they say or make them out to be a fool. A large part of my research into these cases is mostly me talking to witnesses and getting them to the point where they can be comfortable with the fact that I'm not out to make a typical Hollywood Mothman documentary. You know, like we're not going to have insane over-dramatized recreations and a guy in like a Mothman suit chasing people around on a back road. It's just not the way we make movies. And so for me, it's always been just letting them know that we're going to treat them with respect as a witness of something, and allow them to be the storyteller in the film. I mean, that's kind of what sets our movies apart from most of the other documentaries I see on these subjects is our witnesses are the storytellers. They get to tell their story and their account in their own words. And we don't try to kind of trump it up. So that's kind of where I'm at is just letting them know we're going to treat them with respect. And typically if they want to tell their story, it's because they're still trying to convince people or they hope that people won't think they're crazy.
Have you had any stories that have come out after all these years that even surprised you? And if so, can you tell us at least one or two of those before we wrap up for the evening?
When it comes to the Mothman case, we had a guy who's in our film, and I'll try to skim over it because I really want to save some of the unsettling aspects of his story. But he's never spoken about it on camera before. And this guy actually had a sighting back in 66. That involved seeing the Mothman in his bedroom. He actually woke up in the middle of the night and it was standing by his bed. And it was one of the most unsettling stories I've ever... When I talked to the guys that helped me film the movie, the Small Town Monsters crew, we talked after that interview and we all felt like it was one of the best we'd ever managed to get because it kind of... The way he told it, he was obviously extremely impacted by his sighting. And I had never heard this story anywhere else. So it's a really unusual case. It involves literally waking up and finding the Mothman standing beside your bed. And it's something that's haunted him, you know, kind of all the way up until today. So When it comes to the Mothman story, that was the big one that jumped out at me as something that I had never encountered.
Right. Can you tell us, did it try to communicate in a verbal way with this person?
He felt like he was looking at the devil. So he did not try to communicate with it, and he didn't feel like it was trying to communicate with him. He started, he's a deeply religious man, and he started pleading the blood of Jesus. That's what he told us, you know, was what eventually drove the thing out of his room. But the way he told the story is so fascinating, because there's a bit that comes before he woke up. And basically, they came home from church and he felt like someone had broken into their house. But he had searched the house. He couldn't find anyone. He went up to his room, went to bed. And when he wakes up in the middle of the night, there's a Mothman standing next to his bed, when I had heard that, I thought that was the only such account. I thought that was kind of the only account of a nighttime in your house kind of sighting of the Mothman. But I came to find out that Linda Scarberry recounted similar things. She claimed that she woke up one night, looked out her bedroom window, and the Mothman was standing outside of her window. So it's bizarre and unusual, and it's not something I've heard recounted in many of these, you know, Mothman movies, but it's something we seem to be digging into a little bit as we're making ours.
Do you look at alien encounters? Do you look at some of the different descriptions of alien beings across the world, and do any of them map out with this kind of I know it sounds similar to encounters, but do they map out physically to looking like any other kind of alien you've heard of?
The descriptions of the Mothman itself by the Scarberries and then by Marcella Bennett honestly remind me of a slightly taller version of an alien gray, but with wings.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to, you know, your typical alien encounter story, that's the only thing that I immediately connected to, like ufology or kind of, you know, alien myths and physical descriptions. But there's so many bizarre kind of descriptions of Mothman that fly in the face of everything Marcella Bennett and the Scarberries described, that it's hard to know exactly what was going on. There's an account that took place where a person actually did claim to see the Mothman fly up into a UFO. It took off into the sky and then kind of disappeared into a UFO that was in the sky. So John Keel believed this was a case of ultra terrestrials, basically interdimensional beings. So it's, you know, as to whether or not this is a flesh and blood cryptid, or if it's something spiritual, or if it's an alien, we have kind of all of these ideas covered in our film because of the fact that everyone that we spoke to seems to have a different take on what happened to them. You know, like one guy's telling us he saw the devil in his bedroom, and another lady is talking about how she saw a UFO in the sky and then a strange flying being, you know, beside the road. We kind of have it all covered.
What type of conclusions do you come to then when you hear that there are these encounters? There's definitely some activity taking place in and around Point Pleasant, West Virginia. But if they all seem to be so different and varying, what do you take from it personally?
Yeah, I mean, I'm typically very skeptical of these things, and I've always been, you know, I try to approach everything very objectively. And part of this for me is figuring these things out for myself. When it comes to the Mothman, I don't know that I have any kind of theory yet on what took place. When you're talking about the thing that throws me early on in this, I remember having a discussion with my producer, and I told him, you know, it's totally possible people were just misidentifying an owl, because what the Scarberries described has been, there's a guy named Joe Nickel who's a skeptic, and he's basically tried to disprove any Mothman sighting as being nothing but a barred owl. And he makes a believable case for that. But the problem with that is that it isn't the exact same description across all sightings. There were five pilots at the Gallipolis airport who claimed they saw a large winged bird that they originally thought was an airplane until it got over the airport. But they described that creature as having a 4-foot long neck and a beak like a pterodactyl. And that is nothing like what Linda Scarberry described seeing out at the TNT factory area, but it's, you're talking about a span of maybe 5 miles from Gallipolis to Point Pleasant. And their sighting took place just a few weeks or 2 weeks after Linda Scarberry's sighting. So it's possible those guys saw a sandhill crane. And it's possible that Linda Scarberry and the mallets misidentified an owl. It's totally possible.
But if their descriptions make it sound
that that's what it is,
if their descriptions make it sound like it's a taller than average gray, that would
6 foot tall.
Right. Right. That would not seem to fit with any kind of owl. I mean, there's big owls out there, but nothing that reaches over 3 feet tall, I don't think, you know, so how do you, you know, to dismiss it that easily by just saying it's a barn owl.
Exactly.
That to me sounds almost even more ridiculous than the claims themselves.
That's my problem often with skeptical arguments against a lot of these things. And I say that as someone who's rather skeptical, but when you try to dismiss everything with one pat answer and it's something like a barred owl, it's, to me, it's exactly like you said, it almost stretches the boundaries of imagination more than the actual descriptions of the Mothman. Because you're again, these people saw this thing standing by the road and then were followed by it back to Point Pleasant. If you believe the Scarberry Mallet sighting, they said it actually stayed with the car and they were doing 90 to 95 miles an hour down the road. I don't think an owl is going to move that quickly. So, you know, some of this, you have to put a certain amount of faith in what those people are telling you. But at the same time, so many people were recounting things similar to what the Scarberries and Mallets recounted seeing. I personally don't necessarily buy into the large owl as being the source of all of the sightings, but I do think it probably was the source of some of these sightings. There was a sighting that took place 4 days after the Scarberry sighting out at the TNT area by two volunteer firemen. And what they recounted seeing was essentially just a very large owl. And there was an owl, a very large owl, that's stuffed and is in the Mothman Museum. And it was actually killed not too long after those sightings. So there was a large owl. But when you're talking about a large owl, you're talking about an owl with about a 4 foot wingspan. You're not talking about a 6 foot tall man-like bird creature with a 10 foot wingspan.
Well,
I get that he had
not morphed yet. That's what it was, Seth.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, Seth, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Everybody go check out smalltownmonsters.com to find out more information about all of his projects and documentaries. You can familiarize yourself there and find a way to be a part of the Kickstarter campaign and get some really cool swag and be a part of this new documentary, The Mothman of Point Pleasant. When we return tomorrow, Sean Wickens is our guest. Tolerable conspiracies. Some secrets are good for you. This is either going to really piss a lot of people off, Tim, or make a lot of people happy, or a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for tonight. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you to Seth Breedlove. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save